The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I have been looking forward to speaking on the discipline of children with fear and trembling, just because of the reasons that Ron said, that I am the parent with my wife of five children, and if that's not humbling enough, we now have 15 grandchildren, and you can see there are many, many different ways that you can go astray as a parent and a discipler, discipliner of children. And I could tell you all evening about some of the mistakes I've made and provide both amusement, laughter, and tears for all of us together, but I won't have time to do all of that, but I'll tell you something about the things that I have seen as mistakes. Now, I'd like to begin by talking about what I believe are the three major problems in the discipline of children. These are general problems, and we'll get into some specific ones later. The first major problem is insecurity on the part of the parent. The feeling you don't know what to do and you don't know how to do it. There's nothing worse, perhaps, than actually not knowing what to do and how to do it than feeling you don't know what to do and how to do it. The reason I draw a little distinction there is you might be very weak in parenting skills, but if you were pretty well convinced that you couldn't be helped, I think that's really a disaster. That you feel that whatever is involved in parenting, in disciplining of children, I can't learn it. I can't figure it out. That's the worst problem that you possibly can have. Even though you may have many problems, you don't know how to do many things, but if you've made up the judgment in your mind, you come to the judgment in your mind, you don't know what to do, that is really serious. And you need to get rid of that. Now, I think this insecurity as to being able to perform the task is fed by fears from many sources. One of them is simply the task is too difficult. Only the experts know what to do. I'm not one of the experts, and therefore mentally I kind of resign getting any goals, any standards, or any principles. And then a second fear is that not only I don't know what to do because people like Dr. Spock or Eric Erickson, they know, but it all confuses me. There's also today the preoccupation on the part of experts with early childhood. And as you read them and as you have a lot of popular thought spread into our magazines, radio, television programs, there is the feeling that if you miss it when the children are very small, or if they pick up some sort of trauma or damage from your bad management, then you've lost the game permanently. And therefore, you become sort of hypnotized with fear that when you get this little bundle of joy, that you're going to do something wrong of a very serious sort, and it's going to turn out very badly. It's sort of a sneaking suspicion, like a dark cloud in the back of your mind. That's very widespread. I remember in a particular case, a particular instance where someone, a mother, brought her four-year-old son to me, and she announced that the psychiatrist had told her he was already a homosexual, and there was not anything could be done. And I said good night. I hope that he's wrong. I believe he's wrong. And I looked at the boy and just watched him a bit, and he had some problems. But it was amazing, in several sessions, it was clear that the psychiatrist had been mistaken, but the mother had been making some major mistakes in training the child, the way she showed affection to him, and we straightened that out, and within a relatively short time, he was back on a normal track. But man, what a thing to drop on somebody, that this is where your child is, and there isn't a thing you can do about it. Just sort of live with it. And that was pretty rough for her to take. Then a third thing that feeds fears is their conflicting voices. You come here tonight, you're not sure exactly what I'm going to say. You're hopeful it's helpful. But you do know that there are some people in our society who are experts who go in the direction of permissiveness, and then there are others who tend to be authoritarian. And you're kind of wondering where all these voices are going. Where do you fit in? What really is right? And then a fourth thing that seems to me is a problem in our time. And I think this is much deeper than anyone knows. It's kind of an unconscious thing. And it kind of scares the daylights out of you if you think about it. And it's the widespread assumption that whatever is wrong with your child is exclusively your fault. I think that's a dynamite thing to throw at somebody. It's presupposing that the child is by nature good and that whatever he gets from you is very likely to be evil. I saw this cartoon a few years ago in which the child had come home and was showing his father his report card, and it was all F's. And the child was saying to his dad, "Dad, which is it, heredity or environment?" And complete loss of responsibility for the child. If in the past the tendency was to blame the child for everything, I think sometimes the tendency today is to blame the parents for everything. It's the home if the child goes wrong. And the child then can't be helped with his or her conscience. A fifth fear, which leads to insecurity, which I have been stressing for those who just came in, that insecurity is a fundamental problem for parents. And this fifth one is that discipline, especially spanking, is virtually child abuse. That's very widespread. If I know of an instance of some parents who spanked a child in public and were reported for child abuse. And the assumption is that any physical discipline is abusing the child in a wrong way. Okay, now all of those fears are around, and they contribute to this main problem that the parent forgets that there's nobody that knows your child the way you know your child. And you can have some security right off that there's no expert that can know some things about your child the way you know those things. You are the one on the scene, and there's some things that you're going to know about that child nobody else can know. Doesn't mean that you should be the only one helping with your children, and the only source of advice is your own self. But nonetheless, you as a parent have been wonderfully qualified just through experience to watch that child close up, and you know a great deal about that child. So take that as a word of encouragement right off. Then the second problem, major problem, after insecurity, is uncertainty as to moral absolutes and the nature of the child. Now, if you believe that values and standards about child behavior or just human behavior are all relativistic or relative, and the child is inherently good, and you're going to see things through a kind of a glass darkly. They'll never quite get in focus. And when you want to say no to the child or yes to the child, you'll never really be sure that what you said was the right thing. I can remember when I was about 5 years old that I was a dreamer, and I chased butterflies. I gave it up since, so I don't chase butterflies anymore. But I can remember my desire to chase butterflies, and I used to run through our pea patch. I grew up in Oregon on a bit of a farm and a ranch, and I loved to chase the butterflies, and I would always, it was always obscure to me that they were going to run into the pea patch and I was going to trample it down. My mother kept explaining to me that if I did it once more, I was going to get spanked. And I can remember with horror realizing once more it happened, and here I was in the midst of the peas, the butterfly had escaped, and there was my mother with what in Oregon we call the stick of kindling. And she applied it very enthusiastically to the appropriate place, and we knew where we stood. I mean, there wasn't any question about if or but or maybe or perhaps. In that older generation, if you did something that they thought was wrong, that was definite. Well, now, today, that's changed. And you also have parents. I would say, if statistics are to be believed, most Americans steal. And I can remember when I grew up, not only my parents didn't steal, but if they caught me stealing, it was an occasion for great astonishment. And being a proper homegrown WASP boy, I only stole when it was really tempting. It wasn't like kids in the inner city. And I can remember the one time I stole something that my mother's indignation was very high. It was very gentle, but it was very high. And my conscience still trembles, reflecting. It was about 5 years old also. That the indignation she had over the fact that I had taken something from the neighbors. Now, I was able to explain it to her, I thought. It wasn't really stealing. But she was beyond explanation. She just said, take it back. All very clear, all very indignant. And I knew where the boundaries were. Well, if you have uncertainty as to the boundaries for your own life, and you have uncertainties for the boundaries for your children, then you're setting them up, you see, for problems, and it's very difficult then to discipline children unless you recover that. Typically, in American society, English society, our strong point has been an emphasis upon the fifth commandment. I don't know what you have in your mind the way of the background in literature, but Robinson Crusoe, you know, he's isolated on this island. Why is he isolated on this island? He's broken the fifth commandment. He didn't pay attention to his father's advice. And that's why he's there. The fifth commandment is a very crucial thing for our society. Respect for your parents, and then respect for all other authorities, including the teacher. Well, this kind of thing was a settled matter. And if you're uncertain about these things, it's hard for you to get a handle then on what you do with your children, especially as they begin to get older and smarter and ask you lots of questions. A third thing that is a problem today, and some of this is pretty mysterious, and I know this exists in our society, and it's a bit frightening. In fact, it's terrifying that there are so many people who not only have the insecurity and the uncertainty about the task and also about the content and direction of discipline, but also they have lost parenting skills, or they never had them. In the society in which I grew up, nobody thought it was a big problem about the discipline of children. There wouldn't have been a crowd of people turning out to talk about it, to be interested in it. Anybody could do it. But today, what is astonishing is that what was taken for granted back in my generation, at least with my parents, has now become a major problem. That people really wrestle with what once they didn't wrestle with. And this reflects a revolution of a profound kind in American society. And I think it was first pointed out very clearly in the book by Nathan Glazer and David Reisman, The Lonely Crowd, in which they noted that Americans had moved away from being what they called inner-directed, that is, with a conscience, strong conscience, to being outer-directed or other-directed. And in other words, they said traditionally Americans had a gyroscope inside which kept you stable. You know what a gyroscope does? In a ship, it keeps it in balance. When the waves go up, it tends to go straight, level, because the gyroscope corrects it. It keeps it going true over against other motion. And he spoke of the conscience then as being the gyroscope that once dominated the American mind. And but he says now people are much more like those who have radar or antenna, and they're constantly looking to see what other people are doing and taking their values from what the crowd is doing rather than from what their conscience says. And he sees that, they see that as a great revolution. And I believe that that's true. And I believe that revolution has continued since this book came out in the early 50s. And so what I would say then, that it seems to be that the uncertainties and the insecurities in respect to the task and the standards have led people to somehow almost forget that there are parenting skills and being so other-directed that they just have become paralyzed. And my background for some of this is just isn't reading, but Ron didn't mention this. We have taken in our home many people that had personality problems, conflicts, people in state hospital, other institutions. We've also taken into our home people from the county and from a private agency. And we have seen parents function or try to function. They just didn't have any parenting skills. They didn't have a clue as to how you directed a child to do something. And what you had was not so much a parent directing a child, but you had two children fighting, or three children fighting. That's very typical today. And those parenting skills then, I believe they've been largely lost because of the insecurity and the uncertainty. People have just given up and allowed themselves to drift. Are you with me up to this point on what I'm saying? Now, why say all of this? Well, so that you may understand that I'm not coming just in a dogmatic way saying, now look, this is what you have to do. I want you to think about what I'm saying, but I want to give you some kind of intellectual schema, pattern for what is being said, so that you can evaluate it a little more broadly. And if you hear me say something very firmly, that you would call it dogmatic, I would call it firm, whichever word you choose, that you might be able to see, I'm not simply representing an older generation, but I'm talking about something that you have to see, does it work or not? Is it really grounded in reality? So let's now talk about some solutions and begin with some principles. Now, what I would like to say about principles of discipline, and the first one I want to just read to you, and it's simply this. The foundation of all discipline of the conscience, the foundation, the standard, the basis of it really, is the parent-child bond of friendship and love. In other words, shorten that, the foundation of all discipline is that you love that child and you really are a friend of that child. Now, I know that could be misunderstood. I've known parents who were trying to be friends of their children, and really what they were, the children had taken over the parents, and they were trying to be friends in a wrong way. There's going to be some distinctions there, and a child can't handle you just trying to be buddy-buddy exclusively with that child. That's too much. But nonetheless, the heart of what you're doing is winning that child's friendship. You are showing love, and it's that that gives all power to anything you want to do to touch the conscience. So from start to finish, you're out to be that child's friend, not just in a pretend way, but in a real way, that you're really committed to that child. And you want to express that, and you want to communicate that, you want the child to understand that, and that's from front, beginning to finish. I would say this is where it all begins. Right? The second thing would seem to contradict what I've just said. Such a nice positive thought now is going to be replaced, or not replaced, but is going to be another one added on, which seems to be dreadfully negative. I'm preparing you for it. And the principle happens to be the child will go as far as the parents permit in trying to do his own thing. In other words, the child will do as much as you allow in the way of bad behavior. Now, that may be not true in every case. You have to be careful. And I stated it a little more strongly than perhaps is warranted. But generally, you who love the child, must face up to the fact that the child will just about go as far as you permit in the way of getting his or her own way. It's foundational. What you permit, the child will do. Where you draw the line, that's where the child will go and no further. The Dobson films have made that point rather effectively. Now, what it means in that, therefore, and here's where you want to hold on, is that there's a built-in teacher in every child leading the child to try to get away with whatever permitted. Children are born radically selfish and self-centered. Now, I know that wouldn't appeal to many modern psychologists, but having been a parent of in the history of theology, we had a British monk, Pelagius, who taught that man was inherently good. That was always instructive to me. Being a monk, he had no children. If he had had children, he would have known differently. Because when you have children, the first thing that dawns on you from those early cries is that this kid wants his or her own way, not second, third, or fourth, but first, all the time. And it's there. There's the built-in teacher leading the child astray. You don't have to teach a child to do wrong. They will learn how to do it without any aid on your part whatsoever. What you have to do is teach them how to do right. Now, you don't have to agree with that, but that's what I believe fits reality. And if you don't see that, I think you're going to be really confused about how to discipline children, because you're thinking you're disciplining. When I was a teenager, I used to ride a horse, and I thought this horse was a noble animal. And this horse bit me. Every day when I jumped on its back and rode off into the sunset, its first effort was, we had scaffolding on the barn, and it tried to take me off on that scaffolding. The scaffolding was about that high, and if I didn't watch it, that horse was going right under that scaffolding. And finally, it dawned on me, that horse has a mean nature. And if you don't watch out, you're going to end up dead or broken or something. Well, the same thing with children. You'd be surprised how mean kids can be. And they're not always mean. Some of them have a nice, sunny disposition. But even that sunny disposition is centered on ego and on self. And so whether it's a nice egotism or whether it's a nastier one, the child will stop only when you make the child hold the line. So where you ever put the line, the child will stop there. All right, the third matter is that discipline, including spanking, if it is consistently used and explained with love, will not damage a child, but provide emotional stability. In other words, proper discipline will build emotional stability. Put it in very plain English. Good discipline builds emotional stability. And I guess what I'm really implying by that, it's not wrong to be in conflict with your children. There are wrong ways of being in conflict with your children. There are many wrong ways, but it's not wrong to have some conflict with your children. My own thinking is that the more you can work through that when they're younger, the better. Because when they get to be teenagers, it's more difficult to work through. But think about that. And then the fourth matter is that you can teach respect for parents as the centerpiece for the discipline as a whole. The children can be taught respect for parents. Most of the world does it. We believe it can't be done in America, but it's done in most of the rest of the world. And American children are world-renowned for being rude, and especially in relationship to adults. And you can teach them to respect their parents and even enjoy it. I've even known children that grew up eventually to like their parents. And it was tied in with teaching respect. In my own background, my mother was a wonderful person, and I don't remember my father because he was killed when I was very young in a hunting accident. But my mother was a wonderful person, and boy, that fifth commandment she laid into me. You mean you would lie to me? I can't believe that you tried to lie to me. Boy, that carried me as a gyroscope through a lot of tough things. You know, respect your father and your mother, and whatever you do, you don't lie to them. And that sense, you could even feel it, couldn't you? Three generations past, or four, coming right down on through to you. And that kind of conviction, you see, can be taught to a child, and a lot of it is somehow sort of handed on by the way you feel about things. All right, a fifth thing, and I'd like to have you listen closely to this, because it's the beginning of something that is practically very important. Not the other things aren't practically important, they are. But it's simply that babies and small children learn primarily through authority. The babies and small children learn primarily through authority, and there are many things that are involved in that. And by authority, I don't necessarily mean authoritarianism or dominance or crushing or something, but rather a loving authority in which certain things happen. One, babies and children learn by repetition. You don't. If you try to explain the laws of mathematics or a lot about the principles of reading to children, they won't get it. Small ones. Or anything else. You just tell them the facts. You show them the facts, and you just keep repeating. It's all authority. It's all a given. And you do it by emphasis, repetition, modeling, example, and all the rest. And if you start off with the illusion, you're going to reason with small children, you're going to confuse both the child and yourself. It doesn't mean you're arbitrary or cruel with the children. It just means that in consistency, you do certain things according to patterns, and the child learns from those patterns. That's just all there is to it. Now, what I'm going to say later is, it's very foolish, though, to think that's how a teenager works. Do you see what I'm leading up to? That there are stages which, in discipline, you can't discipline a teenager the way you discipline a two-year-old or a four-year-old. And if you try, you're going to set yourself up for some serious problems. This is speaking out of some painful experience. All right, the sixth point is the most severe form of punishment is not spanking, but exclusion or rejection when it takes an unthought-through form, a cruel form. Now, I think that is kind of shocking for people to hear because we're so familiar with these terrible things of child abuse. And we have had children living in our home who have been abused, and it's really frightening. But it's still true. As we watch those children, the worst thing done to them was not the physical punishment. The worst thing that was done to them was rejection. And so in the case of planned discipline, the most severe kind of discipline is not spanking. I don't mean it can't be severe. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's too severe. But a more severe form of punishment, and if it's not handled properly, a more destructive thing for human personality is rejection. The mother or the father who turns on the ice and freezes out the child can feel the resentment and the anger, but the parent may even never express it verbally, or rages, which constitute rejection. These things are harder to handle than physical punishment. Now, that sounds a little radical. I don't know anyone else who says that in our society. I'm not trying to patent it. It's yours now. But you may not even agree with it. But think about it. All right, the next point I would like to make is that the most destructive pattern of parenting is rigid, angry, authoritarian father and a highly permissive and inconsistent mother. That's right out of the old Gluck studies. It's not original with me, but it's certainly true. They studied all these criminal types, young people who had already had severe criminal patterns, and they discovered this was what was involved, that where the father was highly rigid, authoritarian, angry, and the mother was extremely permissive, just let anything go on, that this was almost a surefire guarantee to create aberrant behavior, criminal patterns. Now, I don't say that to scare you to death if you feel that's your pattern, because they were talking about some pretty extreme people. Some of us are quite shielded from what some extreme people would be, but certainly that's a pattern that we don't want to encourage. All right, the next point is 8, discipline must always end with reconciliation, physical, emotional, verbal. By that I mean that if you are disciplining a child, you're doing something wrong if you simply discipline the child and it doesn't end in reconciliation. Simply to exclude a child, you can't have your supper, go up to your room, or a spanking, or whatever form the discipline may take, and then not to let it end with some kind of reconciliation, some kind of physical, emotional, even mental reconciliation, explaining what's going on, I think you're playing with fire. It's not going to be helpful. All right, number 9. As far as teaching is concerned, which is part of the matter of discipline, because discipline isn't an isolated thing, it's involved in the whole package of how the child, parents and children relate. A foundational thing is the joy of the parents. The fact that the parents enjoy life, they enjoy the child, and they are very interested in the world about them. All that kind of joy is very foundational for the child's learning. What you enjoy, the child will enjoy. And really this is important as a kind of a balance. I think people with a Christian background or a conservative religious background are very likely to spend so much time saying no, 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 and you must say no, and I'm for saying no. They need to have it balanced over against the joy of their living in the world that God has made. And you teach the child in the early age. You know, I'm from Oregon. In Oregon, it rains. People ask me, what's the climate like where you came from? Well, I said, it's beautiful climate, and you'd really love it if you'd like to live under a waterfall from about September till June. And then we have a wonderful summer. But then the thing that I noticed as I grew up being, through my parents, wonderfully sensitive to the different kinds of rain. Very sensitive to the way the wind blows, where it blows from. And there's a kind of a joy in the natural world that came through my parents. And you see, if you're only disciplining the child without this more total discipling of the child with joy, you're really setting yourself up for communicating to the child that whatever you are, the child won't want to be when he or she grows up. So the idea is, instead of complaining about the weather the next time whatever happens, you take your child out and you sit in the car and you listen to the rain. You say, now listen, that sounds different than on our third floor. You notice that? Let's listen. What's the difference? You know, really wonderful. Instead of saying, oh, good night, rain again. And you see, you get it off of Channel 6 and they say, bad weather. Listen, you haven't seen any bad weather around here. All right, you see, that joy needs to be there. And you got to have it there, even for your own sanity, because if you don't enjoy things, you're going to end up hating life and people and the children. All right, we'll go ahead now a little faster. Number 10 is what I call repentance. Now, when people hear the word repentance, they get a misunderstanding. They often think of somebody being very grim, but what I have in mind is somebody living in the real world, and that you're open to correction yourself, that you're open to being changed. And if you see what you're saying to your child, that you need to be changed, you need to do this, you need to do that, and if that child never sees you be changed, or even talking about it or admitting it, the child is going to have trouble understanding how it happens. In other words, you're modeling by your change, by your seeing certain things and you've been wrong, and you learn to apologize to your wife, your husband, you learn to apologize to your children, and everybody feels more comfortable with everybody else. Everybody's a little more real. Now, the reason I got this out of my past is this was a criticism given to me by my daughter Barbara. She said, Dad, when she was alienated from the Christian faith for several years and from God, and I went to her and asked her, what did I do wrong? Tell me. And then I sort of braced myself, but I knew we were old buddies. We were real friends. And she said, Dad, you had it too much together. She said, always you had all these people sitting around admiring you, as long as I can remember. And I was one of them. But she says, nobody has it that much together. That's not real. And I says, dear me, I certainly didn't, and I'm very sorry for having given that impression. I really am sorry. Do you forgive me? And boy, did our relationship begin to return to normal. And today, you know, she and Angelo lead the youth work in our congregation here. And very good at helping rebellious teenagers and knowing all about it. So the thing is, you might even call it the joy, the freedom of not being perfect. Does it make sense? The freedom of being honest. I'm not perfect, and I have weaknesses, and sometimes I lose my temper or whatever, or I freeze you out. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. Now, hopefully, you won't do that hypocritically without any change going with it. You want to work on the change. All right, then the 11th is that as a foundation for all of it is that only the message of Christ crucified can qualify a parent to discipline wisely. And the reason I say that, what happens to us as parents is that we constantly get irritated by our children, and we build up some pretty nasty grudges against them. We have preferences, we create jealousies among them, we're inconsistent in our discipline, and if we're going to be changed, we have to know we're loved ourselves. You can't change very much. If I just tell you, you've got a built-in teacher like your child, and that built-in teacher shows you how to do wrong just like your child, and you say, ugh, this guy's right, I'm in despair. Well, that isn't the end of the story. The rest of the story is that God loves you just as you are. And he sent Christ into the world to die for sinners like you and me and to take away our sins so he doesn't need to have anything against us. He's never angry with us anymore when we trust in Christ and turn away from other things we do that are wrong. And when we do that, he always accepts us. He's always our Father, and he's not against us anymore. And so you can always, as a parent, then go back to your Father and get your forgiveness, get renewing, get cleansed, and go back to your family with a little bit of springtime, even in February. Do you see how that works? It's very simple. Okay, now we need to go into some other practical matters, methods of discipline, and I want to try now to pull together some of the things I've been saying in these principles. Let's begin with a 2 to 3-year-old. We all have heard about the terrible twos, and we all went through them. Now, we've forgotten how we behaved. And so the terrible twos. And the first thing I would say is that in a disciplined situation for the 2 to 3-year-old, authority is going to be the strongest here. It's going to be much more in the background when you get to be 15 or 16. Authority is the strongest here. And the way to discipline a child who is 2 to 3, here are some things that go into it. You give a minimum of explaining. And 2 to 3 can understand some things. For instance, Jay Adams often says about the child who's going through the door and you're getting irritated every time that child goes through the door, he or she slams the door. And you say, just every time after that child goes through the door, don't slam the door. And the child just slammed the door. Do you think that 2 or 3 year old is going to understand? Remember, a half hour later, don't slam the door? So what Jay White rightly says is explain just before the child gets ready to go through the door. Don't slam the door. Then if the child slams the door, you have a confrontation. You're on fair ground there. You're not putting the child in a bad situation. And so the other thing, in disciplining a 2 to 3 year old, you've got to recognize some of his or her limitations. And what do those limitations consist in? Well, simply this. There are certain things there that are just lots of life and bounce and vinegar, and you don't want to fight necessarily with that. And that's even good to cultivate. You don't want to crush a child. And so what do you do? Well, if you say to a 2 year old from across the room, don't do that, what's he going to do? He's going to do it right then and there. I don't know why, but I know he will. Maybe it's that built-in teacher, whatever it is. But what you do is you go across the room, and he's just ready to stand right next to the child. Your physical presence is very important to him or to her. Authority is kind of proximity. Now, I don't mean, you know, the local harpy has arrived, but rather that in a very firm, clear voice, you say what the child is not to do. Now, you've already made a judgment where that vase should be there, and you have decided that vase shouldn't be removed as part of the general plan of non-destruct around the house, and that that child ought to learn not to pull that vase down. Well, if that's what you've decided, then you stick with it, and you tell the child, close up, don't do it, right? And if you do that, then what happens when he goes right on ahead and grabs the vase and off it goes in the floor? Well, you do need, at this point, seems to me, some quick evaluation. Were you really making a mistake in leaving the vase there? Should you have taken it away? Was this just too much of a temptation? And so you need to think that one through. In other situations, you might ask yourself, is this just high spirits? Is this young lad or little girl tired? And am I fighting something other than a disobedient spirit? Now, how do you decide this? Well, one thing you watch for, usually, which is very helpful, is the body. You look at the body, and if you are standing close to the child and you say, don't do it, and if the child is rebellious and stubborn, and this is a crucial issue, the child's body will stiffen. Didn't you ever pick up one of these 2 year olds and 3 years old and you've got the board, the straightest board in town, and you got, there's what calls for discipline. And when you see that, that's what you want to deal with, and you want to deal with the conscience. And the point that you're trying to do, get across, is, first of all, I would say what my mother used to say, Jack, how dare you? I can't believe you did that. You know, those soft words coming to me with all the cutting edge of love and yet indignation, astonishment. That's sometimes very appropriate. But sometimes the 2 year old, he doesn't get that astonishment. And that's where I think the spanking is good. And then the third stage is always reconciliation, which you take the child in your arms, you love the child, and if you're a Christian parent, then you pray with the child, and you always aim at reconciliation. Now, if it doesn't work, you may have to go back through it again, and you keep at it. Now, with a 4 year old, here you're getting a different situation already. It's still, authority needs to be strong with a 4 year old. Believe me, if you let the 4 year old take over, you've got a monster on your hands. One of the first couples that I helped with their 4 year old was back in the 1950s, and they had not disciplined the 4 year old all his life. They had no parenting skills that I could see whatsoever, any understanding of the task, no, complete insecurity and uncertainty, and he had never been disciplined any way possible. He had the whole house in total chaos. You'd have thought even selfishness would have caused them to fight back, but he had complete control. His schedule was that they ate at 7 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and at 6. He ate at 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 to 5. He ate at 10. He ate around 2 or 3, and he ate again in the evening somewhere between 8 or 10 whenever he decided he wanted to go to bed. And his favorite weapon was a stick. And here was our own dear little Roseanne, and he would pick up a stick at one sight of her and start beating on her. But you'd say, man, there isn't any hope for this fellow. But he was my first real strong learning, and within, I would say, 6 months, he had been completely changed. When I say completely changed, he still had a very strong personality, but at least he could live in society, and they could too. It was so bad that we invited them for Thanksgiving dinner. They were neighbors of ours, and they said, no one would have us. And I said, why not? And they said, well, Lauren. I said, what's wrong with Lauren? And they said, well, have you seen him? And I said, no, I haven't really noticed him. Well, they said, here's what he's like. And I says, well, you bring him over and I'll control him. Oh, believe it or not, I believe in the power of prayer. And he and I got along just fine, and he sat in my lap. He was so starved for love. You see, when a kid gets to be that hateful, you can't love him anymore. I mean, it so resented him, they'd frozen him out. And when he discovered I loved him and was willing to put up with a little bit, but then to be firm, I couldn't get him off my lap. And so then I just laid out a pattern for her that she had to maintain strong authority, but now she's starting to have to explain. Explaining becomes much more important when the child is 4 years old. Reasoning is really can be pretty clear, it can be very definite, and you can go through an awful lot of things about rules. Also, you'll find as you progress, you cut down on the number of rules. As you get older with the children, you try to get fewer rules. And so with the rules, what we tried to do is to spell out the rules, keep them as kind of minimal, and then in dealing with the child and disciplining the child, is watch for behavior patterns. By the time a child is 4 years old, you know pretty well what he or she is like. And I remember one of our grandchildren that had a problem with anger. She threw things at her mother. And we took her on a trip, and her behavior was great for several days. And then at the end of several days, she threw a beautiful tantrum and vanished underneath the table. Well, my wife is good German in background and believes in order and doesn't like tantrums. And so she extracted Kimmy from underneath the table and had a good talk, and Kimmy was very stubborn and willful and couldn't get anywhere, so she spanked her. But then afterwards, she sat down and said, Kimmy, what's going on here? And why are you angry? Who are you angry at? And it turned out, she says, I'm angry at my mother, and I throw things at her. And I hit her, too. So what did we do? Well, we said, we're now reconciled with you, we're at peace, but wouldn't you like to know about this Jesus who can come into your heart and take out that anger? We didn't give her a lot of big theological words, but we said Jesus can take anger out of your heart. Do you believe he can? Yeah, I do. Well, let's ask him. So she asked Jesus to take anger out of her heart. She also asked him to come into her heart. And what do you know? She was really different. And then she went home, and not having achieved complete perfection, but enough that her mother was astonished, that we talked to her, and we said, now, anything else at home that bothers you? She says, well, yes, I really hate to help my mother. She was now getting towards 5. Clean the house. I hate to pick up the stuff in my room. I don't know whether this fits with anyone else. But we said, well, there's a helper. Did you ever hear about the helper? Helper? Who's the helper? And we said, well, that's the Holy Spirit. Jesus wants to live inside of you with his Holy Spirit, and he'll help you. And when you don't feel like it, you can talk to the helper and say, helper, I need some help. I don't feel like cleaning up the room. And so then she went ahead and did it, and her mother said, it's most amazing. But in this, wherever there's rebellion, you watch for the pattern, and then you deal with the pattern, going after the conscience. You try to get the pattern out there to that four-year-old, so the four-year-old will see what he or she has been doing. You're not dealing with a little machine. You're dealing with a human being who must be respected. You can't just really force obedience. You have to deal in a really systematic, loving way, but also with authority. Well, then when you come to the 10-year-old, it seems to me different methods are beginning to come into play now. A 10-year-old is a delightful child to have around. At least they used to be. I don't know, maybe we've changed them by now. But 10-year-old used to be the best time of life. 10-year-olds are energetic and happy and full of fun and all the rest. And when they get to 11, 12, junior high age, then all kinds of things begin to break loose. But with a 10-year-old, I think you need fewer rules, and you also need more use of consequences of their own behavior. For example, with our oldest daughter, Roseanne, whose daughter I was just talking about, when she was just a little beyond 10, she was going to a school party. Well, we lived in California at the time, and we asked her if she knew the directions, and she says, "Yes, I do." Well, when we talked about those directions, it turned out that she really didn't. She had taken the name of her chum, where she was going to have this all-night pajama party, slumber party, out of the phone book. And you know, and we're white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASP types. And we live clear over in one side of town in Redwood City, California. And Roseanne had taken this phone number, Jamie Rivers, out of the phone book. And she led us all the way across town. In fact, not only she led us clear up to San Mateo, almost to San Bruno, and following this, and we just let her go. My temptation was to say, "Look, you are really wrong." And I said, "Are you sure?" "Absolutely sure." You know, she learned that from her mother. We Millers are often wrong, but never in doubt. Now, she was never in doubt until she got her sleeping bag, and I did not drive off because we were obviously in a different part of town. And here she walked up to the door and knocked, and a very large black man came to the door, and he said he was Jamie Rivers. Well, we let that sink in, and I didn't say much when she got back in the car. And I just let it sit with her. We had taken the whole evening to get her just what was a 10-minute drive across town to her friend's place. And, I mean, hours had been involved in this before we got through. She said, "Well, I know another place where it's got to be." And so we went traipsing around and around, and it was a terrible evening, but it was very instructive. And you may say, "Well, you're foolish to do that." But it was very helpful to her just to let her go and play out the string. We parents often, we forget that God can teach children the same way he teaches us. So we let her play out the string, and it was just one thing after another. She never got to the slumber party. We finally returned home exhausted. And so I sat down with her and said, "Well, Roseanne, why don't we review it? You tell me what you think about the evening." It was one of those opportunities where the local pastor sees the golden opportunity to keep his big mouth shut. So I simply asked her, "How do you interpret what happened tonight?" And she went over and she had a very good interpretation. And basically she had the same problem as her father, a lot of presumption. You know, picking a name of, what she did was ridiculous. She picked the name of her schoolmate out of the phone book. Not the parents. She looked at, she had a schoolmate, Jamie Rivers, and she picked Jamie Rivers out of the phone book. And so we went over this, and a little painful to have it all out there. But you see, giving her the consequences of her own action was much better at this stage than some sort of outrage or anything. It was a different setting. And if you're trying to discipline children always in the same way when they get older, you're going to run into problems. There might be a place for corporal punishment as they get older, okay. But what you need to ask yourself is this a situation where it demands this or some kind of punishment by separation, or is it punishment by just letting the child play out the string for a while. And you have to have some flexibility as they get older. Now, when you get to 16, what do you do then, besides despair? So the problem in America is when the child gets to be 16, a lot of the influence is from the peers and not from you any longer. That's a fundamental fact of life. There's been a recent study which says the parents have much more influence than they think they do, but I think I want to examine that study more closely, because my experience is that teenagers are strongly influenced by their peers. What do you do at that age? Well, it seems to me that what you need to do is to hold again to a minimum set of rules. Not too many. Not too many. But then hold to those rules as firmly as you possibly can. Not with absolute inflexibility, because sometimes you need to look into the situation and adjust them. But what you're doing is cutting down the number of rules and then trying to hold to those that you've decided are important for your family. Now, sometimes that is a very difficult thing. I mean, you have the problem. The 16-year-old wants to drive. Now, all of you know that my son today is a very responsible young man. I mean, he really is. He insists that his father shape up in all departments. But when he was 17, he drove. When he learned to drive, there was one period in my life for about a year where I was affluent, and I had two cars, and I had a beautiful station wagon and a VW. And he was in my VW, and he was backing out, and he had the fender, the VW, up taking paint off the Bonneville. I could say, oh, man, I can't stand that, you know. And the question came to my mind, what do I do with him? And I had the rules out there, and at this one point, I had to decide, I'm going to have to let him go on with his driving. And I was just doing a lot of praying. And sure enough, it only cost me $800. Well, the insurance company, and I hated to have it happen. But this truck in front of him slowed down, and he was going too fast, and he was into the truck. Well, when you have that, you kind of say, well, he learned from it. And one of the things, then, you've got to keep in mind, at this age, it's where really the matter of friendship is very important. And the way you've built that friendship through the previous years is crucial. If you've got the gyroscope in there, you can be sure that eventually that child is going to come out okay. And you can just let that child, in some areas, you just can watch. Now, we Americans are against watching and waiting. It's against the Constitution. I understand there's an amendment in there somewhere. It says never wait, never watch, keep it moving, right? At least it's unwritten, but it's there. Well, now, sometimes you just have to watch and wait with the older young people. If you've done your work well, then when they get those experiences, part of their problem is they've had no initiation. In our society, they don't have to do much work, and they're uninformed about many things, and you just have to let them have some experiences. And sometimes you just sort of sit there and hold your breath, but you've got to let them do it. When they are 16, 17, 18, you can't treat them, though, as though they're two. What you can do, though, at this age, is take into account that their conscience can be reached, and when they make mistakes, and they make sometimes some pretty serious ones, you can talk it through patiently and with love and lead them to the Savior, who is able to show them the way of forgiveness and sanity. Well, I have definitely run out of time, and I don't know, Ron, do we want to take time for questions? A few minutes for questions. I kind of rushed that last section, but if you have questions, I'll be happy to take a stab at trying to answer them. Yes. I was basically trying to discourage certain kinds of exclusion, rejection, and then trying to get to see that it can be used, but it should be reviewed as a severe thing to do. Here's the simplicity of it. Everything I'm saying takes for granted that you are forming a love bond with your children. Now, most of us don't do the job we should. But we should be working on that all the time, from the time they're just little in our arms right up to the time they get married and on. And if you have that, then to send the child away from you in any form as a form of discipline is more severe than spanking. If there's really a close love bond with you, and therefore you should realize what you're doing. And what I'm against is the, here's an example of it, the permissive parent who lets the kid develop into a monster, right? And then, because you can't stand your monster, and yet you believe you're really being very tolerant and liberal, you will freeze out the child. You really can't stand the child. And this is why there's so many emotional problems in our society. This rejection. And here's where it really gets bad, is where the parent verbally says, I love you, I love you, I love you, but the child can feel signals from the body, the tone, the mind, says, I hate you. So I'm really trying to get you to see how it can be used. If it is used, the exclusion, it ought to be used knowing what you're doing, never by way of freeze out. And we all do it. I mean, there's no one here who doesn't freeze out people. Except maybe me and Ron and a few others. No, seriously, we all do it. If somebody does something we don't like, we turn down the temperature. Anybody here else do this? Okay, we got a few. All right. The rest of you, turn up the temperature. Boom! Okay. Well, probably that's better than just to freeze out. And so what I'm saying then, if you were to work out some sort of graded scale of discipline, the first level is explanation, then astonishment or indignation, and then the third level would be most serious, would be spanking, and then exclusion is the most serious. And hopefully you won't use exclusion as your basic way of discipline, because I think that is the most serious problem in the family. Now, I do think child abuse is a terrible problem, but I think child abuse only comes out of that kind of exclusion being practiced. Yes? Well, my mother was very effective with... Oh, I'm sorry. The question is, there's been a lot of talk about not using your hands when you spank the child. My mother was very effective with a stick of kindling. We had a lot of wood in Oregon. We don't have that much wood around here. And I did not grow up favoring the stick of kindling, but I admit it was extremely effective. It just had that nice touch that got your attention. I don't know whether I'd want to make a big case one way or the other. I think the danger for the use of the hand is that some men have very strong hands, and it might be, if they were, you know, losing control, it might be a bit destructive or dangerous. So, yeah, Rosemary specialized in the wooden spoon. And I basically used my hand, I think. But I have a small hand, I'm not too strong, so maybe the kids thought I was stronger than I look. But anyway, I would think it would be a matter of wisdom what to do. I think what you should ask in discipline, see, here's the key, what I'm driving at. In any form of discipline, what you're moving towards is to have that child's spirit humbled. That's what you're after. And that's the basis, then, of your reconciliation. And it may take different forms. But I would say, I don't see anything wrong with a pat on the backside. I noticed one of my grandsons, John. Now, John is, he's more like my wife, I keep telling her, and she keeps saying, he's like you, Jack. Anyway, a few years ago, he was over at our house a couple years ago, and he's really tough. He did something bad, and I asked him to stop it, and he refused, just flat-out rebellion. And I tapped him a couple of times, you know, well, a little bit more like that, you know, and he looked up and he laughed. I thought, man, here's a chip off the old block, you know. So I tapped him again, and he looked up and he laughed. And I said, John, I'm going to do this to you again. So I did it again, and he looked up, and he laughed. And I said, well, John, we're going to be here for a while. It wasn't severe or anything. It was just firm. And then at that point, he burst into tears and was very repentant, very soft-hearted. There wasn't anything violent in it at all in our interchange. But the whole idea was to get that spirit changed. And you watch the body. It doesn't always mean tears. The body is the key to whether there's forgiveness. Yes, John?
You suggest a strategy to sort of keep in mind for a tantrum.
Okay, well,
Montgomery Beaumont and your friend drops on the floor screaming angry, won't cooperate.
Yes. Well, you have to use your judgment as to if this has happened at Montgomery Mall, it's also happened at home. It's not going to be happening at Montgomery Mall if it's not happened at home. And here's where you need creativity. If you've got a serious problem with it, where we had children living in our home that were emotionally disturbed, if it really was extreme, we had an extreme problem with a youngster, he and I, mostly he, went under the shower, the cold shower, and I just turned it on full blast and held the child right under that shower. It does wonderful things for humbling. In fact, it even humbled me. I was about as, almost as wet as one of our children was. But I learned that from some Christians who are very effective at working with depressed people. If they wouldn't change their behavior, they'd put them under the shower, and they found they had wonderful success. It really has some sort of a shock effect, they said. And I'm not recommending it if your wife is depressed to put her under the shower, or if your husband is depressed, if you're strong enough to put him under the shower. But it's interesting that, you know, you can be, I think a tantrum under the shower seems to be beautifully appropriate. But if you've tried the shower and that worked for a while and now it's out in the public mall, yeah, I would try to get the child off in a corner somewhere and apply appropriate discipline to the seat of education. Yeah. Somebody else? Lois.
What if they don't want to do that? How long do you wait for? Does that mean your discipline was...
Some of that is very difficult to know, especially since I failed with one of our children here. We Millers tell it all, so, I mean, you can ask my kids all about it, and we don't have any secrets, as far as I know. And so you can ask Barb about this if you want. But when she was very small, and she was quite rebellious, upon occasion, and I think it was once over peas, and another time it was over some other things, but I think I failed in being willing to go through the conflict. Sometimes you just get bone weary as a parent. Do you ever get bone weary? You know, if this child's going to do that, blah, you know, and you're just going to let the child go, that's not love. Because what she didn't get worked through when she was about five, in going through it and going over it till we got it settled, we had to do when she was about 24. And I'll tell you the end of a beautiful story. Remember, I went to her and she pointed out my weakness and I confessed it. And we just began to become good friends again. And still her behavior was really not good. And she moved back into our house for a while. And it really was quite a challenge. And she eventually had to leave. We asked her to and she agreed to. But then she began to change as we prayed for her, and she was, by this time, had turned all the way from being, she said, a black sheep to trying to be a white sheep, and she wanted to show what she could do now, and so instead of tearing up the turf with a lot of bad things, she went back to Temple, and she got her degree. She began to work on a PhD at Stanford and all the rest. Anyway, to get to Stanford, she didn't have enough money. And so the elders and the church got together and a couple of other people and gave her all the money she needed. And it just really overwhelmed her with the love of it. And when that was done, I went to her determined to have our big fight. And I sat down and I came into the room. She was in our living room. And I said to Barbara, you know, Barbara, I just would really hate to go to heaven and only take you along as a beautiful memory. And she blew up. All the Miller temper came out in one condensed volcano. And she raged at me for maybe 7, 8, 10 minutes. And after she was through, I simply said again, I was going to hold the conflict now. The love had been shown. She was convinced everybody in the church loved her. She was overwhelmed by it. And so I simply said, Barb, I don't see what you got so upset about. I just told you how I feel. And she raged again. And I repeated the statement just before she raged, and that's why she did it. And this went on for, I guess, 15, 17, 18 minutes, as mostly her talking about me and saying everything she could think of in anger. And then I think I repeated it once more. And with real tenderness, but still holding my ground. And at this point, she ran across the room, fell at my knees, burst into tears, and said, Dad, we're going to have to do this more often. Now, I knew from that point on her life was going to be different. And, you know, the beautiful story then that followed in her becoming a Christian. So it's really a beautiful story. And her influence on so many people, Angelo's change, all of this, I don't believe would have happened unless I had been willing to go through the pain of that conflict. So I think you just have to keep at it and see where you are. And I, as a Christian, believe you should pray for a lot of wisdom.